Welcome, folks, to another episode of The Bible Show. My name is Sam. Joining me is Will, and still rocking a little bit of the mustache, but like he's building a beard around that thing.
You know, we're figuring it out.
I think he's liking it, people.
Are liking in the comments, so.
He's hearing too much good news. Anyway, I want to start this episode with a year-end financial appeal. Like, one of the facts about ministry, and this is kind of an interesting thing, for as long as I've been in ministry, I've heard this fact, that between 25 and 40% of a typical ministry's revenue comes in the last month of the year.
Wow.
And that's when people are looking like, okay, I've got tax-deductible donations to make, I've got money or stock or whatever to give away. And so that's why we're hitting this again. If you appreciate the shows and you're interested in partnering with The Bible Show and Under the Hood, I want to encourage you to click the link below, make that donation. Will and I, we're not pulling in revenue or money from this, but it does take a lot to produce these shows. We got lighting, filming, audio and video editing, all the online management across YouTube and TikTok and Instagram and X and Spotify and Apple Podcasts, studio rent and electric and utilities and all that kind of stuff that's not super exciting, but is absolutely necessary for the show. And so if I'm making a pitch to you and I'm saying, hey, this is a good investment with kingdom dollars, we really want to exalt Jesus and to spread the kingdom and you believe in the show, let me just give you some statistics that I think are phenomenal and mind-blowing. Like when we started this, we never expected anyone to ever listen to us.
It's true.
But this show now ranks in the top 1% of podcasts, even when competing against every other genre. So like you throw in entertainment and sports and gossip stuff, like the Bible study, the Bible show is competing against that, which is amazing. According to the latest analytics, the Bible show and Under the Hood across all of our platforms have amassed more than 125 million views, 370,000 subscribers, 8.5 million online engagements, which is likes, shares, comments. On YouTube alone, our viewers have watched over 1.4 million watch hours, which is wild.
Yeah, 1.4 million hours.
That's just insane. That's like almost a couple centuries of watching the show. Every new month, we set records on Spotify, and the shows are growing. And here's one of the cool things that I love about this. YouTube says that we have viewership in 215 countries and territories, which is incredible. Mm-hmm. Spotify tells us 21% of our viewership or listeners is international. And so like, why am I sharing this? It's not because, oh, look at what we've built. It's not. Yeah. But it is because I absolutely hate asking for donations. But I think we're a good investment for the kingdom of God. And you can go through different episodes and videos, and you read through the comments of people saying that it's helped them to understand God and grow closer to Jesus, which is the goal. Like, that is the true reward for us. Like, that fills our hearts. It's so encouraging to read those things. We hope to do that for as long as God allows us to do that. But for that to be possible, we need people to partner with us. And so if you're in a position to partner with us, please give us some consideration to do so. If you can't, like, we want you to watch, don't feel guilty about it. But if it's something where you're like, you know what, God has really blessed me and I want to use my resources to advance the kingdom, and I like this show and what they teach, like, we would love for you to consider clicking the link below and considering making that contribution to the Bible show and Under the Hood.
And you've kind of already mentioned both these, but if you're not in a position financially, like you said, that's A-okay. Mm-hmm. But leaving a comment about what's happened because of this podcast in your own life, or if you've come to faith, those kinds of things, even they're good for our hearts. But also as we go out to people, there are more reviews about like, hey, this isn't just a podcast where we're talking. Like, we really think God is using this and we'd love your support. So a comment does wonders for us as well.
Yeah. All right. So moving on from that and getting into the fun stuff, we are moving out of Exodus chapter 4, moving into Exodus chapter 5 and 6. And so if I'm reviewing and I'm looking at where we just came through in the last couple chapters, God came to Moses at the burning bush. And what has he done? What happened at the burning bush?
He told him his name.
Told him his name.
And his mission.
And the mission. Like, my name is I Am That I Am. Shows that he's transcendent and yet draws near. But then he says, hey, Moses, I want to send you back to Egypt and you're going to free your people. You're going to go to Pharaoh. You're going to say, let my people go. And then the last chapter and a half, what has Moses been doing?
just straight up objecting.
Yeah, he's throwing down like, this is why that doesn't work. This is why that doesn't work for me, God. Why do you think Moses, or why did we discuss this? Why is Moses so reluctant to go back?
Because he's already tried this. He's already proved that he was not the guy they wanted. And now God, what, 40 years later is saying, no, you're actually the guy now.
Yeah. So after 40 years of being humbled, remember back when the Egyptians rejected you and the Israelites told on you for killing the Egyptian and went to Pharaoh and upended your life? And, you know, they basically said, I don't want you, go away, and sent you off into the wilderness. Well, now Moses, who's dealt with this for 40 years, didn't circumcise his sons, seemingly walked away from the covenant, is adjusting into Midianite culture. All through this is like when God says, hey, I want you to do this, he's objecting. Lack of qualifications. Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? He's anticipating rejection because he's faced it once before. They won't listen to me. He's like, what is your name? Like, he's coming up with all of these interrogations of God. Like, I'm not eloquent. I can't speak. I don't have the capacities to do this. And then eventually, when God's like making accommodations for every single objection, what does Moses finally just, what does he say? Just send someone else. I don't want to do this. And so God will not allow him out of this calling. He just keeps nagging, nagging Moses. You ever feel that way with your calling?
Like, yeah, which is so, I mean, it's awesome that he does that for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love that if God calls you to something, he's going to establish you to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter what your call is, even if you think it's not possible, that if God truly has called you, and we're talking about real, like real ones, not some crazy ones that we've made up, that God's going to be the support and back that wholly.
Yeah.
And I think obviously Moses is a perfect example. If anybody didn't want the call and maybe was not as qualified as an 80-year-old man that's about to walk and lead a million people,
yeah,
maybe he's not qualified. And he isn't qualified, but that's God the point. Says, I'm going to do it.
Yeah, the point is, this is impossible apart from God.
Yeah.
Like, which is always the way that he works. It's so that he gets the glory and nobody's, no, I believe it was the 80-year-old that was past his
prime.
Look
at the 1% I gave.
Yeah, and it's not just that God is saying, this is what I'm going to do, and everybody's going to know that it was me that accomplished this so that God gets all the glory, and Moses will share in it and all that stuff. But he's refusing to let Moses out of his calling. And I think there's something about God's faithfulness to not let you go out of what you've been called to that feels like nagging sometimes. Like Moses is like, just go. Like, I don't want to do this, right? And yet God won't let him do anything else. And when I first got into ministry, I remember somebody saying, like, when I was saying, I think I want to go into ministry. I think I want to do pastoral ministry. Their advice to me was, try to do anything else. And it was like, what does that mean? Do I stink? Am I really bad at this? Like, why would you say that to me? And the response was, if you can do something else,
go do it.
Go do it. But if God dries up everything else, if he doesn't give you a passion for anything else because you are so meant for this, then you have a calling on your life. And I thought that was helpful. And the reality is every time I've ever transitioned from anything, it's always coming back to teaching the scriptures. Lifting high Jesus. Like, that's just what I want to do. I could do any other job and I would end up doing this in that job. And I think that's interesting. Like, God is coming to Moses, who's like, I don't want this. Like, I'm happy to do the shepherding thing. And God's like, no, I've got a plan for you. I'm not letting you out of this.
Because it's interesting that I'm just thinking this now, but like, he felt like he had the call 40 years ago and it just wasn't the right time. Mm-hmm. Like, he had the passion to do it.
That's right.
But it was more of a waiting thing on God's end for a timing thing to say, okay, your call's still the same because it feels like you wanted to do this 40 years ago. Let's continue to do it. But now is the right time.
Mm-hmm. And there's so many people out there in ministry who have some major event, some major blow up, some major issue that comes along and you're like, I thought God was in this, but this was so painful. This just blew up in my face. Yeah. Maybe it's not for me. Where it's like, well, it's just not God's time yet. Like, it doesn't nullify the calling necessarily, but maybe God is doing something bigger that you can't imagine right now in the middle of the pain of dealing with the blow up or the church split or the whatever that happens. And I think that's where Moses is going to slowly go through kind of ministry healing, you know, as he's launching into this next phase of his life. But it's a big deal. Like, at the end of this chapter, they both show up to the Israelites, you know, and it kind of Moses reluctantly is like, okay, I'm going. And they're like, okay, this is what Yahweh says he's going to deliver you. And how do the Israelites respond? Like, it's like all of, it's not like last time.
Yeah. It's worship.
They're like, amazing. Thank you so much, Moses and Aaron. This is awesome news. We're going to worship the Lord. He's about to deliver us. And you'll remember, like, as part of what they told Moses and God told Moses was, I'm going to go and you're going to give this message. And what's Pharaoh's response going to be? His heart's going to be hardened, but don't worry. Like, I, by the power of my hand, I am going to bring about signs and wonders, and eventually he's going to let you go. And so keeping all that in mind, we jump into chapter 5 today, verse 1. And it says, afterward, so after talking with the elders and they're all excited and woohoo, God's coming to save us. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went and said to Pharaoh, can you imagine how terrifying this would have been?
Why were they allowed to do this?
With Pharaoh?
Why did these two guys have access to talk to Pharaoh?
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, maybe Moses is playing on his identity, but he's also coming as kind of a foreign emissary. So he's coming from Midian. He's a newcomer coming in. It's like the wise men showing up to Herod, you know. How in the world do you get to do that? Well, he's coming as the son-in-law of a foreign priest, and also this isn't the main capital of Egypt. Pharaoh would have been staying here as kind of a northern depot. So it's not all the same fanciness as what it would have been in Thebes or Memphis. But it says, Moses and Aaron went and said to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. One quick thing that I think is interesting here, when Moses comes and he says, thus says the Lord, one of my favorite things is when you get to the New Testament, prophets always say, thus says the Lord. So Moses is the first major prophet, is going to do a lot of thus says the Lord, thus says the Lord.
It's kind of their whole job.
Mm-hmm. When you get to the New Testament, what is it that Jesus always says that sounds really weird when you hear it? And it's like a kind of a redundant statement, but he'll say in the King James, it would be, verily, verily, I say unto you, right? Or truly, truly, I say to you. Do you ever think, like, why would Jesus say that? That's such a redundant statement. It would be like, will, truly, I say to you, and like, then I say something, and it's like, well, of course, you're just said it. You don't need to say that. Why does Jesus say, truly, I say to you, so much?
Because it's this.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing that the prophets were doing. He's just not a prophet.
He's not a prophet. It's
God.
I am the Lord. Yeah. I don't have to say, thus says the Lord, I say to you, which is like Jesus claiming again and again and again and again and again as he's going through the Gospels, teaching these things. I don't need to say, thus says the Lord. I am the Lord. Mm-hmm. I say to you. So just when you're reading through the Gospels, you'll see that now and you'll be like, man, that's bold, because that's exactly what he's saying there. But as we're going into this, like, it would have been crazy to go into Pharaoh's presence and to make demands. And the reason for that is we've talked about this or alluded to it. Pharaoh was a god to the people. Yep. Like, this is what they believed about Pharaoh from the fourth dynasty onward. So by the time you get to Moses, more than 1,000 years, these pharaohs were called Sa-Ra, which means sons of Ra. They were considered the embodiment of the god Horus, who was the son of Ra, who came into the world and took a form as the king of the Egyptians. So this is a divine figure, son of Ra, the embodiment of Horus. When they died, we know this from tombs like Seti I was a pharaoh, where he's called Osiris Seti. And then in the script, it says, justified, lives eternally among the gods. And so when you get to Moses' lifetime, inscriptions from pharaohs during his day, the king lives forever like Ra every day. Or he is a god by whose command we live. So you're going before a pharaoh who, all of the Egyptians are like, this is the son of Ra. This is Horus. When he dies, he's going to be united with Osiris. It is by his command that we even exist. And you have Moses going up to this guy saying, like,
we got to go.
Let my people go. Like,
I'm going to worship a different god.
That's correct. You see how, like, this would have been, even with God's voice behind you and all that stuff, this would have required radical faith and trust to be like, what's to keep him from just slashing me and throwing me in the Nile.
Yeah, so you start to get why Moses is hesitant. I know we didn't bash him last episode, but we did talk a lot about his objections. And there are very true ones that even though they're not faithful to God, that we feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's so much that Moses has to swallow to go through with this mission. You know, pride, fear, bitterness toward all these people. Another thing that's interesting about what happens here, this famous line, "Let my people go." In the Hebrew, this word has like a, there's like a financial sense to it where it's like you're releasing your claim on them. You're signing over the deed, right?
Because he owns them.
Yeah, because they're property. These are my property. I own these slaves. Like, they are mine. And when Moses is coming saying, let them go, it's like, I need you to sign on the line that this is no longer your property, but now they belong to a different God.
A bill of sale.
A bill of sale, in a sense. And they're going to go and they're going to worship that one true God, not you, Pharaoh, out in the wilderness. That word is shalah, and it's used in binding contracts. It's kind of an interesting thing. When you get to the New Testament, that same idea comes to play when Jesus is on the cross. And what does he cry out from the cross? It is finished. And the Greek word there is tetelestai, which means what? The debt is paid. They had a financial obligation to God. They were in debt. Their sin, you know, they owed more than they could ever pay. Jesus goes to a cross. His last words, tetelestai, which means the debt's paid. It's over with. They are bought and paid for. You know, the New Testament's going to come and say, you were bought with a price, right? Well, what is that? Where were you bought? You were bought on the cross. You were freed from your former master of sin and death, and now you're bought, freed to go worship the Lord in utter freedom. You now belong to him. Your master is gone. The sinister, tyrannical master of sin and death has been taken away. And so even with this first thing, it's not just, hey, let my people go. Like, let them walk over here for a while. It's sign them over. And it's a bold claim. And so what you're to sense at the beginning of chapter 5 here is a worship war is starting. This is, they belong to this God, not you. Sign them away. They're done serving you. We're going to go have a feast. And so you feel this tension of, dang.
Yeah, it's not a casual ask.
That was bold. And it was bold from a religious sense of things, right?
He's not just a political king.
That's right. That's right. And so verse 2, Pharaoh said, who is the Lord? Literally, who is Yahweh? Who's Yahweh? That I should obey his voice and let Israel go. I don't know the Lord. And moreover, I will not let Israel go.
Two strikes now.
So here's something that's interesting, because in Egypt, they're polytheist, right? Like, they've got, I mean, so many different gods. I mean, you can sit here and name them. There's a bunch of them. What's so bad about having another one in the mix?
I mean, well, this one wants to be the primary one, it seems.
Yeah, this one is, you no longer own them. You have no claim over these Hebrews. I want them. And so Pharaoh is not closed to the possibility of a new God, but he does not want this God to speak with authority over him. Like, this is not going to happen. Do you know who I am? I am the son of Ra. I'm Horus. Like, and so he says, who is the Lord that I should obey him? And that is at the heart of every single moment of our lives. Like, that is what we should ask. Like, who is the Lord? Is he basically, what Pharaoh is saying is, who is this God? Is he worthy of my obedience? Why should I follow him? Like, why? What has he done that should make me go, oh, Yahweh, like, I'll give my whole life to him. I'll obey his commands to free all my slaves. And that's the reality. Every time you come to a moral decision or anything that has claim on your life, the question is God worthy of my obedience? Who is this God? Mm. What has he done? What's the answer? How would you play that out in your mind?
Yeah, it is one where Pharaoh is doing something weird here that I've never thought about by wondering who Yahweh is. And it is just a real question about, like, okay, like, what is it worth to you even? Mm-hmm. Even our own lives, we do it. We just don't think about it as much, I guess. Like, what decision do I make? Do I trust God to go left or to go right? Or do I not?
Mm-hmm. And at the root of every decision is, which one is most worthy? Yeah, what's worthy of my affections? What's worthy of my obedience? If I feel like money is going to be more worthy and it requires me to go that way versus what God wants, but money is more worthy in my sight, I'm going to obey that one.
Yeah.
Right? And so Pharaoh is asking the right question. Who's God? Who is the Lord that I should obey him? Is he worthy of my obedience? Is he worthy of me giving up everything? Is he worthy of me giving up my title and everything else that I have? And by the way, remember, he's the serpent-crowned king. And he's getting at the root of the very same thing that the serpent back in Genesis 3 asks, which is, did God really say? Yeah, right?
The distorting, like, of it.
Right? Like, he comes with a command, and it's like, let me see if I can twist this, poke holes in it. And he's following after this, right? And as we'll see, as this unfolds, Yahweh is not just interested in the Hebrews getting to know who he is. He'll repeatedly say things like, the Egyptians shall know that I am Yahweh, that I am the Lord. And so as this unfolds, God is going to show them, no, he's worthy of everything. He's in charge of everything. And we internalize that, and practical applications is asking the question, is Jesus worthy of our obedience at a sacrificial cost? And verse 3, what is their answer? They said, well, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Now, if you're Pharaoh, is that impressive?
No, because they're enslaved.
They're slaves.
And they've been enslaved for a long time, so obviously this God has forgotten about
them. Yeah. That God? Oh no. Right? And so the response is, I mean, that's not a good appeal. And then notice how they start backpedaling. You ready? Please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with sword. Now, why would they put it that way? Right?
Because now he's saying God's going to kill us if you don't let us do this.
Yeah, like,
you're going to lose this anyways.
What did God say? Remember back in Exodus chapter 4, verse 23, God is saying, if Pharaoh refuses to let you go, hey, Moses, this is what I want you to say to Pharaoh. If you refuse to let them go, then what? I will kill your firstborn son. That's what Moses is supposed to say. One chapter later, he's in front of Pharaoh being like, if you don't let us go, God will kill us. And Pharaoh's like, yeah, I'm good with that. Like, that's no big deal to me. But Moses is struggling to trust and believe the Lord. You could understand that. If you're in front of a warlord or somebody who's a violent guy and you're like, hey, if you don't obey me, God's going to kill your son. Oh, really?
Yeah, it's practice versus the game. We all can shoot a foul shot when we're alone at a basketball hoop, but you put us in an intense moment.
But this isn't, I mean, it's intense, and you get the feel like they're shaky. They don't trust God to protect them in this moment. They start backpedaling on what they're sharing and not sharing. And it says, verse 4, but the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people away from their work? Get back to your burdens. And Pharaoh said, behold, the people of the land are now many, and you make them rest from their burdens. So here you get at the difference mindset between these two gods, gods. You have Pharaoh, who's
that,
like,
was air quotes for our audio listeners.
But here he's like, are you kidding? Like, if this could result in these people resting. And to him, that's anathema. Like, how could slaves possibly be allowed to rest? And the Hebrew verb for that comes from Shabbat, which is where we get the word Sabbath. So what do you hear in that? Like, here you have Pharaoh who's like, people under my dominion will never, ever rest. They don't get a Sunday. They don't get a vacation. They don't get a holiday. They never have a day off. Their only value in the entirety of their existence is how much they can work, how much they can produce. It is unthinkable to me that we would ever allow for rest. That's offensive. And how dare you allow this, Moses, when the reality is what is the competing God like?
Wants worship and rest.
He commands rest. Like, we have to be commanded to stop.
Yeah.
Because we just don't want to. I mean, we get to a Saturday, a Sunday, whatever, our Sabbath, and it's like, I can't let it go. I've got to check my phone. I've got to get ahead. I've got to let this go. Because in our mind, our entire identity comes from what we produce, right? And that's all Pharaoh can see of these people. It's all the people could see of themselves. And God's like, no. You want to know where your value is? Stop for a minute. Just come be with me. Stop and rest. That's our God, right? Pharaoh can't conceive of that. And
that makes us look so crazy in today's day and age. Because Pharaoh's kind of makes logical sense. Yeah. He has a people group. He wants them to work. That's all he cares about them for. But we have a God who comes to us and tells us we can have rest and we need rest and we should rest. And we're like, no, we're okay.
Yeah.
We're going to keep going.
Yeah, I'm going to keep burning myself to the core.
We're
going to
die eventually, and we're going to have panic attacks and whatnot, but We'll keep going.
But you, I mean, even when they get out in the wilderness, like with the Ten Commandments, God's got to be like, stop. This is now a command, like that has a steep penalty if you disobey it. Like, do not work yourself to the ground. I want you to set aside one day in seven where you have nothing to do but enjoy me and my creation and to ponder all the reasons that you have to be grateful, to take care of your soul, to feast upon my goodness and the goodness of the people. Like, and we're like, ugh, that command. Yeah. It's like our souls gravitate towards slavery. It's a weird, weird thing. So anyway, verse 6, it says, the same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their foremen, you shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as you have in the past. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the number of bricks that they made in the past, you shall impose on them. You shall by no means reduce it, for they are idle. Therefore they cry, let us go and offer sacrifice to our God. Let heavier work be laid on the men, that they may labor at it and pay no regard to lying words. How do you feel about this?
I mean, real bad response to the people.
Yeah, this is not great. So if you're Moses and you're hearing this, like, so all of a sudden you've done this, it blew up. Pharaoh's like, nope, you just want rest. I'll have none of it. And then all of a sudden an edict goes out and all these people that you promised deliverance to are hearing, okay, from here on out, you're going to have to work even harder. You're going to have to go get your own straw. You're just trying to be idle. You're all lazy. And that word, like, idle literally means like letting your body just go slack is literally what that means. Like, it's stopping from the tension of your work. And here's, I think, the principle. Like, if you take this story, because this is a real historical story, but if you apply it spiritually, this is one of the things that you realize when you start doing ministry, that, or just being a human, when you have a taskmaster. So what is that? An addiction, whatever it is, right? And somebody comes who loves you. Like, let's say you're addicted to pick something. Just name it. Go for it, Will.
Let's do drugs.
All right. You're addicted to drugs. That was boring. Anyway, you're addicted to drugs, and I come to you and I say, man, I love you. Like, and I care about you, and I see how this is destroying your life, and I see how it's wrecking your marriage, and I see how it's wrecking your kids. I'm coming to you to demand that you stop your slavery. Stop. Who do you get mad at?
You.
Why? Like, did you see how ridiculous that is? But that's always the way that addiction works. And here's the thing. You could, in your mind, you know that. Most addicts go, they're thinking to themselves, like, I wish I could give this up because it is making my life a living hell.
They want to. They just don't know
how. Gosh, I can't do it. Like, because the moment you stop serving your taskmaster, what happens?
That's the first time there's tension.
Oh, it's so hard. It's like, I remember trying to quit smoking and I'd be like, I'd have to leave my wallet at home so I didn't have like money or credit cards to be able to buy anything, because the compulsion and the pull when you're starting to fight temptation only gets harder. It's like, then it's when it starts getting really ruthless. And it's like, if it's like you feel it in you being trying to compel you, like, no, you can't be free. You can't. And it becomes so, so stinking powerful. And that's what Jesus says is truly, truly, there it is. Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. And it's like, you see this here where it's like, okay, we're going to start talking about freedom. And what happens? The taskmaster here is like, I'm going to make it harder.
Yeah.
I'm coming after you with even more oppression. And that's the truth. When you try to walk away from sin, the taskmaster, the demonic realm, whatever you want to say, whatever the source of it is, that sin becomes so stinking strong. So it's like, try quitting addictions and you realize how strong they are. Like, because the easy thing is, oh, I could quit this at any time. That's like every addict. All right, no problem. It helps me. But then try to quit it and you find out how brutal that taskmaster is, because you can't.
Yeah, it's the first time there's resistance.
Mm-hmm.
You're not walking parallel. You're trying to turn around.
Yeah, that's right. And try practicing radical generosity. You don't think you worship your money? Try practicing radical generosity. Try giving away the world's gods and see how money doesn't have a hold on me. I'm going to tithe to my church and I'm going to help the poor. And I'm going to, you know, my family member who's run on hard times, I'm going to make an anonymous donation into their Zelle, whatever, who knows. But like, try parting with your money wisely, right? You know, there's wisdom to how you manage money. And you'll see how strong that is, that idol is for you. Try letting, forgiving and letting go of bitterness to somebody that you genuinely resent deep in your bones. See if you can utter those words to them and humble yourself and try to seek reconciliation. And you find out how strong that bitterness is. Try I remember one year when we were coming into it, we did Lent one year, and it was like, see what you can give up for the 40-day journey up until Easter. And I remember one of our teachers at our school said, I'm going to give up complaining. And I was like, well, that's dumb. In my mind. Turns out it's pretty brilliant, because you have no idea how often you complain until you try not to, or grumbling like, oh, I deserve better than this, kind of in your spirit. Like, try giving that up and see how strong that is inside of you. Or refuse to cower when it comes to standing for the gospel or truth. And like, say, you know what, I'm going to, even though it's terrifying, I'm going to do this. See how strong the compulsion is to be a people pleaser in you. And there's this great quote by C.S. Lewis, which all this is leading up to, right? When you fight against your taskmaster is when you find out how strong it is. But this is what C.S. Lewis says. He says, a silly idea is current that good people do not know what temptation means. This is an obvious lie. Only those who try to resist temptation know how strong it is. A man who gives in to temptation after 5 minutes simply doesn't know what it would have been like an hour later. That is why bad people, in one sense, know very little about badness. They have lived a sheltered life by always giving in. We never find out the strength of the evil impulse inside us until we try to fight it. And Christ, because he was the only man who never yielded to temptation, is also the only man who knows to the full what temptation means. The only complete realist.
It's good.
He's the only one who's ever fought all the temptations to their end, right? And said no the whole way. He was never mastered by any of them. He always yielded to the will of the Father, even when it came at great personal cost to himself. He always said no to every other taskmaster in his life for the sake of God. And it's like, oof. Now you see the moment that they're trying to leave their slavery. Now apply that to your life. You see just how vicious your taskmaster is. And that's how, like, when I see sin in my life, that's really what it is. It's a brutal taskmaster, and I get mad at anything that tries to take away my slavery. That's where this goes, right? It's kind of crazy. Anyway, so the taskmasters and the foremen of the people went out and said to the people, thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go and get your straw for yourselves wherever you can find it, but your work will not be reduced in the least. Now, one of the trips that I went to Israel, it was interesting. I remember going to a step pyramid at Saqqara in Egypt, and you're walking around at the base of, you know, the step pyramid, and you look at all the bricks, and you're just shining out of it. Like, here's an image. Do you see that?
Yeah.
Do you see the straw? Like, this is made by slaves in the ancient world before the Hebrew slaves. But in all these bricks, you just see massive mud bricks. You see massive amounts of straw in it. And when you hear you're going to have to go get straw, like, what in your mind?
I'm walking 50 yards, getting a bundle of straw and walking back to the brick station.
Yeah, like, oh, no, well, I've got to go grab straw. But the reality is you read different things like Anastasi Papyrus 4, and you'll find Egyptians talking about the crisis of not being able to find straw in their districts. And so what's going on here? Just to understand why this would have been so bad, is every time you had a harvest, so like a harvest of barley or wheat, right?
Okay.
The people go out, they cut down the stuff, they take in the good stuff, and usually they would, you know, you'd think you'd leave the rest of it. But they're like, no, this has tremendous use. Like, we're going to use the straw. So we're going to bundle that up too, and we're going to take it, and we're going to store it because it's used for, you know, feeding. It's horse fodder, animal fodder, all that kind of stuff. It's used in mud bricks. It's used in all kinds of stuff, bedding. So we're going to store this up, and then we'll ration it out. So the Egyptians who have this stuff, probably stored up, or maybe Pharaoh's using an excuse like, we don't have much left, so don't give them any, make them go get their own. They have this stored up, and then they would ration it out to the people. But now Pharaoh is saying, no, go find your own. Except it's not harvest season anymore. It's not like, oh, look, all the leftover straw from the harvest, it's all gone. So now what do they have to do? They've got to run out. They've got to find reeds or grass or hay or whatever, cut it down. And then what do you have to do? Like, it doesn't just turn to straw and hay immediately.
Get you let it dry out.
You got to let it dry out. You got to sit there, and then you've got to bundle it up, and then you've got to, you know, carry it back. Like, I looked this up because I was curious, like, how would you transport it? Because it says they're going to be scattered throughout Egypt. It's going to tell us. But 1 6-foot-tall cylindrical bale of hay, how much do you think it weighs? Like, you know what I'm talking about? Like, you're driving through Kentucky and
yeah,
you
but
see,
like, how big are ones?
6 foot, 6 foot.
6 foot tall? Or?
6 foot tall in a circle, cylinder of hay.
400 pounds.
1,200 pounds.
Whoa.
So it was between 1,000 and 1,500 pounds. So now I want you to imagine, like, okay, you go, you travel 80 miles and you find a good stash of whatever.
Find my straw guy.
You got your straw guy. Now you got to figure out how to get this massive, like, not light, because you got to travel 80 miles, so you're taking as much as you can. How do you get it there? Like, this is a massive, massive undertaking that now we not only have our quota of bricks that we've got to meet, but how much of our workforce is now being sent out miles to go gather the straw. And if we don't do it, guess what? The beatings are coming.
Yeah, then I guess, do they just die? Like, what if they're just like, we can't find straw?
They get beat. You're going to see in a minute. They're going to get beat. Like, the foremen start getting beat. And all of this is time consuming. To create new straws, time consuming. To make a mud brick. Do you know how you make a mud brick?
Honestly, no.
But we have ancient hieroglyphs from tombs where it's like you're gathering up the mud. You da-da-da-da-da. You put it in the little planter. You stomp around all the straw so that it's like rebar. And then you throw it over. Rebar. And then you throw it over. And then that has to sit for weeks baking until it's finally cured. So everything you're doing is taking a massive amount of time, and this just throws a stick in the spokes of this machine, and you have no excuse. It's like, I'm still expecting you to produce the final output. I don't care that we're not providing it for you. You're still going to be beat if you don't measure up.
So this makes this a much more cruel decision by Pharaoh than I think I thought of it first.
Yeah, oh, he knows there's no chance. So he's set impossible circumstances for the sake of teaching him a lesson. You want to try to follow a different God? This is what it's going to be like, right? It gets back to, like, one of my favorite things about leadership. Favorite story of leadership, I think, is really profound, is when Solomon dies. You know where I'm going with this? Solomon dies. And he's enslaved a lot of his people. They've had to work really, really hard to build all his projects and everything else. And when you get to Solomon's death, his son comes along, Rehoboam, and the people come to him and they're like, oh, your dad, he worked us to the bone. Like, we're so exhausted. Would you please give us rest? And Rehoboam's like, what should I do? And he goes to the older guys. And what do the older guys say? They say, man, if you show these people rest, if you just love them and you honor their dignity as human beings, they'll love you and serve you for the rest of your life. That's what you should do. Give them rest. And then he goes to his younger frat party, you know, buds, and he's like, what should I do? And they're like, they dared come to you and ask you for rest. I think you should work them even harder. You should whip them with scorpions. You should, you know, show them how powerful you are. And he's like, yeah, that's a great idea. And so what does he do? He stomps them into the ground, and 10 tribes of northern Israel say, if that's the way you see us,
we're out,
right? And when Jesus comes, because he's like, you thought my father, this is Rehoboam, you thought my father had a heavy yoke, wait until you feel my yoke upon you. Like, and then when Jesus comes, what does he say? So he's talking about Rehoboam when he says, come to me, all you are weary and heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Like, right? I'm gentle, lowly in heart, all that stuff. Like, this is Pharaoh saying, you want to know what it's like to follow me as a God, as your leader? Challenge me. I'll destroy you. You dare question who I am or what my decisions are. You dare ask for the freedom to worship another God. I'm going to crush you. And that's what they're learning right now. And so you have Pharaoh and Yahweh, right? One of Pharaoh's crushing them. And they're drawing nearer to him as a result.
Yes.
That's what's going to be crazy in all of this. So, and you can go through Egyptian history, you know, if somebody were...
Would love to.
nerdy enough to do that. But Thutmose is one of the pharaohs that existed. And in his writings, he talks about whether or not to provide donkeys to transport straw, right? So it's all this is in play. You don't get donkeys, by the way, as a slave. You go do it yourself. They have tomb paintings about whole, the whole process of how they would create straw in the tomb of Nakht from the 12th century BC. And all of this is just Pharaoh flexing and saying, you want to challenge me?
Yeah. This is what you get.
Yeah. So here's the question. If it says, so the people were scattered throughout all the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw. Hang on to that. The taskmasters were urgent, saying, complete your work, your daily task each day as when there was straw. And in the tomb paintings you see, like from this period where the slaves are making bricks, it's the tomb of Rekmeyer is one of them, where you see the Egyptian soldier and he's holding a whip. Can you see that in that image? And it's just like waiting to whip anyone. And in the hieroglyphs underneath, it says, you know, beware, for I don't hold the whip in vain to anyone who is idle. And that's the idea. It's the same language, actually, that you're hearing coming out of Pharaoh here. But I have a question for you. Like, it says that they were scattered throughout Egypt. So here's the question. If the Israelites were allowed to be scattered throughout Egypt, why not run away? Like, it's not like they're like, all right, where are you going? I'm going to follow you, and you're going over here, and you're going over there, and everybody's scouring out all the land.
Well, they probably weren't letting families go out and get straw.
Okay, but any still, lots of people are bailing out to go look for straw. Why not run away?
In your family.
Oh, you're trying to make it like this now. Whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Just for a week.
I'm kidding. But why not escape?
Yeah, this is home now. They're like the elephant tied to the stick. They're like that metaphor.
Yeah. Explain the metaphor.
Like a huge elephant, you ever see them in captivity, they just have a rope around their ankle and there's just like a wooden stick in the ground and they don't go anywhere because this is home to them.
Yeah, and they assume that they can't walk away. Yeah. And so Aaron was free. He could run away and go visit Moses at Mount.
True, he just walked out.
He just goes like, they can leave is what I'm getting at. They can be scattered all throughout. Why in the world don't they leave? Like, get away. What's the answer to that?
They kind of love it in a weird backwards way.
It's safe.
Yeah.
A predictable slavery for a lot of people is preferable to an unpredictable freedom.
Hmm.
Like, I mean, we see that in human culture all over the place. But, like, it does make you wonder, why not flee to Israel or go south to Ethiopia or go to Midian like Moses did? He didn't seem to have a problem doing that. But they don't. They're accustomed to their slavery. They see no hope anywhere else. And so, question, turn the finger around. How are we similar in the same way? Like, how do you get used to your slavery?
We all get used to it. Just like we talked about beforehand, but like this one is such a physical slavery, whereas our spiritual slavery is the same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We get stuck in patterns, just harder to do. Even this is going to sound bad, but let's go for it. I get why there's bad parenting out there because good parenting's hard.
Yes.
It's now that I am actually having to do it, it's like, no, I don't want to fight my 3-year-old all the time. But some days you have to.
Yeah.
And it would just be easier to just be like, all right.
Here's an iPad.
Yeah, world's yours.
Yeah.
Go have fun.
Burn it down. Do whatever you want. Just leave me alone for 5 minutes. But that's reality. There's a question in the New Testament that I think is really powerful where Jesus comes upon a paralytic man and at the pool of Bethesda, and he asked them the question, do you want to be healed? And I always read that question like,
obviously,
of course I would want to be healed. And yet you could apply that same question to us where it's like, hey, I keep doing the same things, knowing where it leads, knowing that it's not good, knowing it's not life-giving. I keep doing the same things. And like, if God came to me and was like, I've given you a path to life, like I've given you the prescription of what a much healthier life looks like. Do you want to be healed?
Yeah.
And I would say, gosh, the slavery, the sin, it keeps wrecking my life. And yet, like, I don't act like I want to be healed.
No.
I wrote down a list here, like staying in a toxic relationship because it feels safer than loneliness. How many times have we come across that? Refusing to let go of a victimhood status because, you know what, to forgive and move on and not be able to say, but this happened to me. Like, that just enslaves you. Let it go. Like, what are you doing? remaining in spiritually comfortable routines rather than risking a deeper surrender. I mean, that's so many of us. Resisting God's calling because it threatens our comfort or control. Avoiding right decision because it risks the loss of approval. Believing the lies of the enemy about your worth and how God sees you. Like, familiar pain feels safer than unfamiliar freedom. And so we just stay doing the same thing that we know the same outcome rather than trusting God and saying, I want to be healed. Stretch me.
Yeah.
Have me do something different that's gonna hurt. And so here's the other question is, why does God allow all this suffering? Why does God allow the words to come out of Pharaoh's mouth that say, oh, go get your own straw. Why not just go, psh? Like, nope, you're not allowed to do that. You're not going to make my people suffer.
I have no idea.
It gets back to what we talked about last episode, where all of this is going to, it's building the contest. Like, why allow? What do you think the Israelites are doing when they're scattered all over Egypt?
They're saying, hey, Moses and Aaron confronted Pharaoh.
And now we have to go get our own straw because our God supposedly was going to deliver us from Pharaoh. And now word begins to travel all throughout Egypt and all the surrounding regions. And everybody begins to hear there's a contest between Yahweh and Pharaoh. This is the same thing that happens in the book of Acts, by the way.
The Jewish diaspora.
Right? Like you, but go to Acts chapter 1, verse 8. And I love how intentional, because it's like he doesn't want you to miss this. He says, you will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you'll be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all of Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth, right? So this is a great commission. You're going to go out and you're going to spread the gospel. And what do? They hunker down in Jerusalem and they don't do anything. Acts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, Stephen gets stoned. Things get a little uncomfortable and dangerous. And how does Acts 8, 1, after the first martyr, how does it start? Listen to this. Saul, the Apostle Paul, approved the execution, and there arose on that day a great persecution against the church where? In Jerusalem, and they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria. So how in the world did God get his people to go and start talking about the gospel out of other places?
Persecution. Suffering.
Suffering. It's the only way that they started sparking and moving out. And now it's through the scattering of God's people, even though it's like to go get straw and they're suffering more. But guess what? A lot of these Egyptians, later on in the passage, when they walked through the Red Sea, were told that a mixed multitude went with them, which means there were Ethiopians that went with them. We know that Moses, after Zipporah, will marry a Nubian. So there's foreigners coming out with them. There's Egyptians coming out with them. How did they learn of all this stuff? Well, they're going to experience it in the plagues, but repeatedly God is going to say, I'm doing this so that the Egyptians will know that I'm the Lord. That's not just in judgment. There's the offer of salvation available to them. You're either going to know him in judgment or you're going to know him in salvation. But it's this scattering that begins to spread this word of the contest. This is all in God's sovereignty.
That's interesting.
So verse 14, and the foremen of the people of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over him, so these foremen have been appointed by Pharaoh, were beaten and were asked, why have you not done all the tasks of making bricks today and yesterday as in the past? Well, they know the answer to this. It's just cruelty. They didn't ask for these positions. They were appointed by the Egyptians. They're given an impossible task. And when they can't do the impossible task, now they're being beaten. But then you have to stop and think, like, if you're Moses, how are you feeling right now?
Real bad.
But think about Moses, like, in prayer life. All right, God, you came to me. I threw up every objection I knew how. I told you these people didn't want me last time. It's like a personal wound of mine. Like this hurt really badly. And now the very first thing that you have me do in ministry blows up in my face. And now everybody's suffering because I got involved. Like
they're
not so mad at you. They're mad at me. Like, yeah. What, why are you doing this to me? Can you step into his shoes?
For sure.
Like there's a lot of times where engaging in ministry causes suffering that then comes back on you. There's so many examples of this where you're like, if I had just shut my mouth, none of that would have happened. I remember going back to my days as a teacher with somebody who was walking through a hard season, ended up going to a facility for treatment, started dating somebody and from that facility. And when I found out that it was unhealthy, I went to this person and I was like, you should really walk away from this. Yeah. It's really bad for you. And she did. And as a result, the boyfriend took his life.
Oh.
And I remember thinking, like, had I not confronted her, which was the right thing to do, and this relationship was borderline abusive, had I not confronted, they'd still be together and he'd still be alive. And I walked around on that, like, all right, like, I don't want to get involved anymore.
Yeah.
Like, I tried to do the right thing for the Lord, and I walked around with that on my conscience and things like that in ministry, where you can't control that. But it's like, gosh, you know, I just should have, you can imagine Moses being like, I wished I'd have stayed in Midian. I should have dug in.
It's easier back there.
Mm-hmm. Because obedience, man, sometimes it makes it harder. So then the foreman of the people of Israel came to Pharaoh, and they cried to Pharaoh. Notice what's changed. Well, who are they crying to at the end of Exodus 2?
God.
Who are they crying to now?
Pharaoh.
That's right. Why do you treat your servants? Notice how many times this is repeated. Your servants like this. No straw is given to your servants. Yet they say to us, make bricks. And behold, your servants are beaten. But the fault is your own people. Like, we love you. We want to be with you. Like, we're serving you with everything we've got. They've given us these unreasonable expectations. Like, please take it off. Like, we're appealing to your mercy, Pharaoh. So in this, God has said, this is what I'm going to do. And nobody's looking to God anymore. Mm. Pharaoh says, you're idle. Yet your arms have gone slack, when the reality is they're working harder than they ever have. You're idle. That's why you say, let us go and sacrifice to Yahweh. Go now and work. No straw will be given you, but you must still deliver the same number of bricks. So here's, he's coming. They're appealing for mercy, but there is no mercy with Pharaoh. Mm. The foreman of the people of Israel saw that they were in trouble, and they said, you shall by no means reduce your number of bricks, your daily tasks each day. And so now the people are hearing there's no relief coming. This is your new normal. This is what Moses has brought you. This is what the Lord's intervention has brought you. Hmm. Why? You ever notice that, that so many times when you start into a new season of ministry or something that's for the Lord, it's like things get harder?
Yeah.
All right, so jumping to verse 20, it says, they met with Moses and Aaron. So now the people are mad, and who are they going to? They're going to Moses and Aaron, not to the Lord. And they're waiting for them as they came out from Pharaoh, and they said to them, the Lord look on you. Like, the people are angry, they're shouting, the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made a stink in the sight of Pharaoh and his servants, and you've put a sword in their hand to kill us. And so, like, everything about this is, I know you came to help us. I know that you're the one who wants to deliver. I know that you've made our taskmaster mad, but we hate you for it. And every time you ever in ministry go to somebody who's in the throes of addiction, or they are struggling with a sin, and you come and you say, man, I love you. Let me help you. I want you to be delivered from this. And they feel that battle, that rage start in them, because they don't want to let go of this relationship with their sinful taskmaster. Like, they get so angry at you. If that's a member in your family, if you ever been there, you know what it's like. And you're like, whoa, 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 I'm the one trying to help. Like, I'm the one coming with the resources. I'm the one who's doing this. And that's the nature of humanity with their slavery to sin, is they will lash out and be like, you're the evil one. You're the one who's making my life worse. When in reality, it's like, you need to leave this slavery. Yeah. Pharaoh is not good for you. Trust me. Like, but this is where the heart is. They go after the prophet. And Moses turned to the Lord because they turned on him. Now
that's
Moses,
the order of operations,
turns back to the Lord and says, Lord, why have you done evil to this people? Now you're like, whoa, that's like a big
accusation
thing to throw down on the Lord. Now the word evil, just so you know, it's like Ron in Hebrew, but it means like to bring harm or tragedy. If you look at other translations, you'll see, why have you brought trouble? Why have you brought harm on the people? But it's like, you've brought things that are not great. These are not good things.
Yeah, the burdens have increased.
That's right. Why did you ever send me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people, and you have not delivered your people at all. And you're like, dang, like, God's just going to turn them into a pile of ash right here, right? And what does God do? Because you saw this all throughout the earlier chapters when we were in Genesis. What does he do? He comes in the middle of their mess, and when they're doubting and unfaithful and they're struggling and to make sense of him, and he is going to double down and be kind to him and explain himself and be patient with them. And by the way, the crazy thing is, back in Exodus 3, what did he say to Moses? Like, let me just read this again. Exodus 3:19-20. I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it. And after that, he will let you go. So God's already told him, like, this is going to take a while. Pharaoh is going to resist this. It's not going to go well at first, but I'm going to show up. It's okay. And they get to the very first moment and it's like, I'm out.
Why not?
Why have you not shown up? And you think, you're looking at the Israelites, and we're so quick to be like, what idiots, you know, like, what's wrong with them?
How could they do this?
But we do the same thing to God all the time.
Even for easier stuff. I mean, there is at least this physical slavery, and their burdens did get much larger. Yeah. So,
and they're facing oppression and beatings. And like,
yeah, for me, it's a much lower bar.
me too, sadly. But you listen to the words of Jesus. I have said these things to you, that you may have peace. In the world you will have
trouble.
Trouble and tribulation, but take heart, I have overcome the world. That should be enough. Yeah. But we hit trouble, and what do?
How? Why?
We do the same thing, right? Mark 13:13. You will be hated by all for my name's sake, but the one who endures to the end will be saved. He tells us this. And then we face conflict where we're hated for the sake of our faith or made uncomfortable or alienated because of our faith, and what do? Well, this is not the way it's supposed to be. And Jesus is like, I didn't hide it from you.
I mean, you knew the game plan.
I told you how this was going to go.
They crucified me, by the way.
You're right, exactly. But this is, when you get to Exodus 6, God doesn't come and be like, hey, knucklehead, like I already told you all this stuff. God says, let me tell you how this is going to go.
Yeah, he doesn't run back the tape and be like.
Just like he did with the patriarchs, he's going to work them through his covenantal promises again. So verse 1, chapter 6, we're going to race through chapter 6. But the Lord said to Moses, now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh, for with a strong hand, he will send them out, and with a strong hand, he will drive them out of his land. And so God's like, I'm going to make it so that he is so desperate to free you that he, with his strong hand, he's going to push you out. I'm going to make you guys so much of a plague to him that he'll do anything to get you out of this place. And what God's saying is, I'm going to bind the strong man. Jesus says, no one can enter a strong man's house and plunder his goods unless he first binds the strong man, which means you have to be stronger than the strong man to bind him, right? Jesus, God is like, that's what I'm doing here. That's what Jesus is doing. So God spoke to Moses and said to him, I'm the Lord. Now hang on to this because he's going to repeat that. What does I am the Lord mean? I am Yahweh. And he's going to repeat this all over chapter 6 again and again and again. But hear the change. He's like, I want you to know I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as God Almighty, as El Shaddai. But my name, the Lord Yahweh, I didn't make myself known to them. That ever-present covenant-keeping God, like I made all kinds of promises of giving them the land and giving them all this stuff, and I was sovereignly weaving through by my power all of their stories, but you're going to feel me in a way different way than they ever did. By my name Yahweh, I didn't make myself known to them like I'm going to make it known to you, Moses. I also established my covenant with them to give the land of Canaan, the land in which they lived, as sojourners. And you know who I'm going to do that to? I made the promise to them. I'm going to keep the promise with you and your descendants, Moses. It's go time. I'm moving. I'm taking action. And so here you see Moses, he's going to give a step-by-step playbook with the plagues. Patriarchs never got that. He's going to perform all these miracles and wonders and plagues. They didn't see stuff like this. Parting the sea, giving water from a rock, raining down manna, fighting their battles, purifying bitter waters, coming in a pillar of fire and cloud, dwelling in the midst of them in a tabernacle, announcing and transcribing a new covenant, giving the Ten Commandments. Like Abraham was a friend of God. He never saw that level. And so God's like, you're going to see, they saw El Shaddai.
Yeah.
You're going to get to know the personal side of me. You're going to see Yahweh. And so Exodus 6:2, God spoke to Moses and said to him, I am Yahweh. Now listen, because he's going to do the promise thing that he always did with the patriarchs. He's like, hear what I'm going to do. I've heard the groaning of the people of Israel, whom the Israelites hold as slaves. This is no secret to me. And I have remembered my covenant. Say therefore to the people of Israel, I am Yahweh. And I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from your slavery to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great acts of judgment. I will take you to be my people. I will be your God, and you shall know that I am Yahweh, your God who has brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will bring you into the land that I swore to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob, and will give it to you for a possession. I am Yahweh. And he's scattering this all out. And between all of these actions, he's like, I want you to know, I'm going to bring you out from your burdens. I'm going to deliver you from your slavery. I'm going to redeem you with an outstretched arm. I'm going to take you to be my people. I'm going to be your God. I'm going to bring you into the land that I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And all of those. And he's like, why? Because I'm the Lord. Because I'm Yahweh. Because I'm Yahweh. You're going to get to know me. I am Yahweh. I am Yahweh. He's repeating this. And all of those promises apply to us. He's going to deliver you from your slavery and from your burdens with outstretched arms that pay for you, to take you as his people, to be your God, and to bring you into a land where you will dwell with him forever and ever and ever. And this is where God is like, okay, now you're going to see me, but I want you to pay attention.
Yeah.
Pay attention to how near I am to all of your moments of deliverance. I want you to see how I conquer the enemy. I want you to know me and my character and my attributes like the patriarchs never did. Moses, I'm drawing near. You're my guy. You're my leader. You're going to see me move like they never did. And by the end of this chapter, Exodus 6:29, the Lord said to Moses, I am the Lord. I am Yahweh. Tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I say to you. And in the next chapter, God says, the Egyptians shall know that I'm the Lord. So I want my people to know. I want you to believe deep in your bones who I am and what I'm about to do. But I'm going to show them too.
Yeah.
I'm on a mission that everybody is going to know who I am. And so Moses comes to the people of Israel, but they're not ready to listen. They did not listen to Moses because of their broken spirit and harsh slavery. And so because they didn't believe, what does God do? He keeps chasing. They're broken.
Yeah.
They've got a broken spirit. They're in harsh slavery. God doesn't say, well, I'm done with you. No, he says to Moses, you go in and you tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the people of Israel go out of his land. But Moses said to Pharaoh, behold, the people of Israel have not listened to me. How then shall Pharaoh listen to me? For I'm of uncircumcised lips, which literally means like these are not faithful. They're not covenant. They're not pure. They're not sacred to carry this covenant message. Like I'm not worthy. But the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron and gave them a charge about the people of Israel and about Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, to bring the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt. And then we get 15 verses that are all in the genealogy. And
yeah, a lot of names.
A lot of names. There's some interesting stuff in there. Notice that a couple of guys live 137 years. So you've got, like, it seems like they're trying to tie them together. Levi and Amram both live 137 years. There's one other character who lives 137 years, Ishmael. Think Galatians 4, moving right along. Verse 26, coming in for a landing. These are the Aaron and Moses to whom the Lord said, bring out the people of Israel from the land of Egypt by their host. It was they who spoke to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, about bringing out the people of Israel from Egypt. This, Moses, and this, Aaron. It's like God is saying, these are the heroes here. These are the ones that did it. On the day when the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt, the Lord said to Moses, I am Yahweh. Tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I say to you. But Moses said to the Lord, behold, I'm of uncircumcised lips. How will Pharaoh listen to me? And so who's the only faithful one in this story?
God.
Everybody else is balking. Everybody else can't even begin to understand how they're going to overcome Pharaoh.
Too.
And this whole circumcised thing, it's kind of interesting. Like I'm of uncircumcised lips. This is always used to discuss people where they have a part of their body or performance or whatever that is not yet submitted to God. Obviously, there's main circumcision, which is the sign of the covenant. But like Deuteronomy 10:16 says, you circumcise therefore the foreskin of your heart and not be stubborn. Jeremiah 4:3 says that you're to remove the foreskin of your hearts. Jeremiah 6:10 talks about how their ears are uncircumcised and they can't listen. And so this idea is what Moses is saying, this is not yet devoted to the Lord in faith. It's uncircumcised. It's not yet sacred. It's not yet fully submitted to the Lord. Like, my lips are not ready. They're uncircumcised. They're faulty. They're profane. I can't do this. I don't believe, maybe even. And so this is where you see chapter 6 end. And chapter 7 is not the Lord saying, I can't work with this people. Chapter 7 is going to be the Lord saying, I'll go to war on my own then. Like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to carry out my promises. I'm going to do these signs. Moses and Aaron, you're coming along, even though you're doubting and trembling and wondering and questioning. I am not letting you go. And I'm not letting them, with all their broken spirits and their harsh slavery, I'm not letting them go. You are my people, and I will deliver you, despite the fact that you don't trust me yet. That's just how good he is.
Yeah.
And so from Exodus chapter 3 all the way through the end of Exodus chapter 6, it's like setting up this title bout. This is a big match that's going to happen between Yahweh and the most powerful empire and the greatest theological pantheon of the ancient world. And Yahweh, in the next 4 or 5 chapters, is going to systematically come to every single one of their God through all of his actions and symbolism. It's so absolutely awesome. And he is going to start saying, okay, plague number one. And he just starts knocking down their gods and humiliating the mythologies of Egypt. Plague two, bam. Plague three, bam. And there's such beautiful symbolism in that. And it all points to the gospel. It's so rich and profound. But we get to see God starting down that road to take on this title fight in the chapters to come. And again, he's just so good. And he's going to get the victory and share it with his people. And that's who our God is. I want to thank you so much for watching today's episode. Join us next time as we get into Exodus chapter 7 and we start down the road of God taking on the Egyptian gods with all the plagues. God bless.